My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Sitar, I would like to say how honored we are to be sharing this time with you today. Our topic is on our response to biological emergencies and is ominously entitled Disaster Planning for Unusual Communicable Diseases, It Could Happen to You. A couple of years ago, a group of experts from across Canada came together as a Health Canada working group to write guidelines for hospital bioterrorism preparedness and response. And for some reason, I found myself on that working group, and it continues to be an interesting experience for me, at least. There has been an awful lot to learn, and one of the things that I learned was that the folk in Vancouver, Canada, are further along in their disaster planning than most or all of the rest of the country. And one of the people principally responsible for that level of preparation is today's faculty, Dr. Elizabeth Bryce. So we'll get right to it. To present Hospital Disaster Planning, Unusual Communicable Diseases, from Vancouver General Hospital and Health Sciences Center, I am delighted to present Dr. Elizabeth Bryce. Liz.
Hi. Thanks, Paul, for your very kind comments. I'm sure the rest of the listeners join me in saying how much we appreciate these teleconferences and their ability to share information. Now, today, I hope it's not too ominous, but I'm going to focus on the larger issue of disaster planning as it relates to unusual communicable diseases. And I won't go into disease specifics, and I won't deal with very highly detailed documents on websites, etc., but rather I'm going to speak to some thematic issues. I'll try to avoid overlap with Dr. Morse's recent lecture. There are many, many excellent documents on the internet now, and I've referenced some, and I note that California is on the line, and one of the many excellent documents actually comes from the California Hospital Bioterrorism Response Planning Guide. So I've listed some. They're not exhaustive, but I hope it may help you in developing your own plans. Now, the next slide acknowledges my colleagues on our Biological Response Advisory Team, and I'd be terribly remiss if I didn't show everyone the team and acknowledge the very hard work that everyone put into this. Next slide, please. We've all seen recent examples of unusual communicable diseases, monkeypox, avian influenza, which is currently visiting us here in BC. The specter of smallpox has been raised a number of times, and of course, very close to home for my institution and others is SARS. And I think it's all given us some pause for thought about how we manage an unusual communicable disease event and what our roles are as infection control practitioners in the overall disaster planning. So I thought the very first place to start is just simply to define a disaster. And it seems a bit simplistic, and I have put a definition in for you there. But what I want to emphasize is that it's something of an exceptional event that has a negative human impact and requires some sort of abnormal intervention that may exceed your resources. As you can see from the next slide, which should be slide 5 by now, disasters, and very importantly, not just the disaster, but the threat of disaster, they're not necessarily unpredictable, and we can identify the hazards. And I think it's really important to recognize the potential of disasters, but also is important to know when we should declare a disaster, because declaring a disaster is rather a formal response that releases resources and activates emergency response systems. And a disaster can be called for different reasons and may be a very small event, such as smallpox. One case would potentially call up a disaster plan for the nation and perhaps the world, or to many cases, such as pandemic flu, for example. If you go to the next slide, this slide underlines four basic phases of disaster management that you really should consider when developing a plan. And for all or any disaster planners online, I think you will be very familiar with this, but it may not be so familiar to others outside that realm. So the first phase is mitigation. And what that is, it's planning to lessen the severity and impact of a disaster. And it's a process by which you identify the hazards that could affect your hospital operations and or your demands for service. And then it looks to support those vulnerable areas. Preparedness, on the other hand, is once you have identified the hazards, it's what you do to build your capacity to manage this emergent event. So it's resource inventories, prearranged agreements with hospitals and vendors, for example, disaster drills. Response is what you do to control all the negative effects that are associated with a disaster. And recovery, hopefully, will begin with the response process, and it's what you do to try to restore normal services. So the next slide shows you some common elements that are part of an unusual communicable disease plan. But why it's in here in particular is to just highlight to you that the majority are common to the management of most disasters. And it's really treatment, prophylaxis, decontamination, specimen transport and diagnosis, and the very specifics of barrier protection that are more unique to unusual communicable diseases. So this is the first in a number of repetitions that I will make about you have a foundation within your disaster manual on which to build from. Let's go on to mitigation, which I believe is slide 8. And what I'm going to do next is just look at the first two elements of disaster management, mitigation and then preparedness, and see how these apply to infection control and plans for unusual diseases. So I've already talked about hazards. I think it's important to state that, you know, you can have something very acute or you can have something that's more insidious. And the insidious hazard is often the more difficult to identify. It's very hard to just come up free-form with all the potential hazards that you may have to address. And I would recommend that you use a very formal hazard analysis when you do this. And there are documents, checklists available for this. And the JCAHO has an excellent document on how to do a formal hazard analysis. And it really is the best method to make sure that you've identified all potential hazards and you've integrated them into a comprehensive plan. Now, some examples to consider for mitigation would be, for example, if you've identified that you have no negative pressure rooms, well, I think planning in the future when you do renovations or build new structures would be a perfect example of trying to mitigate and plan for isolation capacity. Again, you're going to have to do this with your regional group because it makes no sense for you to have a plan to address your vulnerable areas without taking into account what everybody else is doing. So if we look at preparedness next, this slide looks at the priorities in healthcare, and I must confess I've taken it almost directly from the JCAHO's report to Congress, where they identified key areas that need to be supported. And that's referenced at the back, but that's that December 2001 special issue of the Joint Commission of Healthcare Organizations. And it is an invaluable guide to how to set up a disaster plan for unusual communicable diseases. And it gives some personal experience of people who have been through the process. So I could highly recommend it to you if you haven't read it already. So this document looked at what they consider to be and what I agree with are priorities in health care. For example, education. That's disease recognition, patterns of disease recognition, educating clinicians, for example. Creating a single integrated response system that addresses a full range of disasters, SARS is a perfect example of that. Analyzing your community and provincial preparedness, what's available, what's needed. Ensuring that, and I emphasize this word, you have a functioning public health surveillance system, something that has been shown or demonstrated to work. And, of course, we all know issues related to national supplies. For us, that would be vaccines, antivirals, antibiotics. And then the much more difficult final one, which is evaluating all those funding policies that hamper our ability to scale up. And we're talking bed capacity, the lack of redundancy in systems. And I think this goes far beyond the scope of what we can do. It's really something that it should be directed to the policymakers. But it's important to remember. Now, if you look at the next slide, I've tried to give you a very elemental example of mitigation and preparedness specific actually to our site. And you'll see all these arrows which show you our water supply, and then you'll see our arrow as to where we are in the Vancouver area. So part of the mitigation process, for example, identified that we're extremely vulnerable to any connection or disruption in the main reservoir, and that could be from a disaster like an earthquake, or it could be something as horrendous as deliberate contamination of one of our main reservoirs. So one of the things we had to do in preparedness was to be able to switch over to an alternate water supply very quickly, to have stocks of bottled water always on hand and a process by which to rotate that stock. And we're actually looking at partnering with breweries in our areas who are the second largest water users in our city and have very pure filtered water in large, large tanks. So I think I just wanted to use this as an example of how you might identify a hazard, a vulnerable area, and how you might plan to manage that event. Now, part of preparedness is obviously planning, and slide 11, plan development, goes through some general guiding principles. I think that we need to continue to care for patients while taking care of the disaster and doing it appropriately. But I really want to stress here how crucial it is to protect the staff. If the staff don't have confidence in us, if they don't feel secure and protected, then we really undermine their ability to work and our ability to care for others. And I think sometimes this is forgotten in hospitals. We have such a role in caring for others that we sometimes forget that it's very important to care for ourselves. And I think SARS was a perfect illustration of the importance of this point in particular. Now, if you go to the next slide, that lists five guiding principles for the plan. And they simply put are the importance of good links, working with what you have, allowing or developing an alert system, trying to have your backup system so you can function, and making a plan that's really understandable but includes everything you need. And I'm going to go through each of these guiding principles in turn. So if you look at the next slide, what that is simply, I've just done a snapshot off the web to give an illustration of integrating your hospital plan with the region and the community, and that's just our exposure to biological agents response plan that has the hospital sections in there. And biological agents can be anything from pandemic flu, SARS, bioterrorist events. We try to be very comprehensive. If I could give some key points that we've just learned, and, you know, talking about a regional plan is another topic in itself, but I do want to tell you a few things. And one is that it takes an unbelievable amount of meeting time to develop a plan. We started in 1998 and we finished in 2000. We were still revising in 2001, and of course it's an ongoing process. We learned that once you've got this integrated plan, it really is helpful if everyone knows about it and how to find it. Keeping it limited to a few people, keeping it on desk drawers, doesn't work. And in this day and age, really electronic media are the best way to disseminate such a plan. And then the third part we learned is how important it is to assign responsibility for someone to update the plan, keep everything current with reorganization and changing phone numbers. This is a major task in itself. And then the fourth and final thing is think about security. Make sure that nobody can hack into and change your plan. Try to make it as secure as possible. The next slide looks at linking it to your institution and its plans. So we've gone from big, linking it to your region, down to the next level, which is linking it to your institution. And really, most institutions already have a disaster response plan in place. It contains an incident command structure, and I think that was mentioned last lecture, but what that is a system that clearly outlines the roles and responsibilities, who's in charge, what are the lines of communication, how supplies and people and transport and everything that goes into management of a disaster will be managed. And importantly, you should use that as your backbone to developing or integrating your unusual communicable disease plan. Let's go on to the next slide, which is a continuation of that theme. So going from region to your institution, I could probably bet that you already have some templates within your infection control laboratory network that you can link into again at the next level. And that would be, for example, you may have a pandemic flu plan. People in Canada know that in 1997, an unusual communicable disease plan came out that included viral hemorrhagic fevers and unusual flu-like presentations. And actually, that's what we used as our very beginning backbone for integrating our plan. And we dusted it off. It actually was very consistent with what we do now, and we use that as one of our backbones. In the lab, we looked at our pre-existing lab guidelines on high-risk specimen management and integrated that. And on the wards, we looked at our hazardous spill procedure and inserted a section on suspicious packages and powders and their management there. And the advantage to all of this is you have a far greater success of compliance if you use something that's already familiar to staff that they don't have to relearn. Next slide, please. Point two is assume that you're going to be working with what you've got. If you receive any additional funding, count yourself lucky, but reality is that you're probably not going to get much more to work with. And so it's crucial to know your surge capacity, and that's everything from beds to ventilators, personnel, life support equipment, who might help with your surveillance from an infection control standpoint, for example. And you have to do this with your sister institutions, your local community, and public health. The joint APIC and CHICA document on strategies for pandemics and disasters, APIC, JCAHO, they all have disaster checklists that are very useful for assessing what your resources are. The next slide is not meant to be read, but simply I thought it was a wonderful one because the public recognizes that unfortunately when we're looking at resources, most hospitals have implemented just-in-time inventories for supplies. We've scaled back staff, and there is little surge capacity left in the system. SARS and masks, another example, would be SARS and the healthcare workers and the ability to have a pool of workers to come in and fill for the others with the increased workload. These were all things that really revealed the lack of redundancy in the system, and this is something that I would say would have to go up to the policymakers, as I've already said. Point three is looking and deciding how your alert system is going to work. And I think you should consider that a biological incident may initially have very vague symptomatology. One of the things our response group all agreed upon was to permit the system to receive an alert from any source and to make people comfortable with starting the alert process. We would rather be alerted and have a false alarm than not be alerted at all. So our threshold for an alert was low. Now, admittedly, that was a problem after 9/11. I think just in our little area alone in Vancouver, we had 107, if I recall, false alarms or deliberate hoaxes, and it really taxed the system. But when we reviewed, would we do anything different? We still kept our threshold low, but we developed more refined and defined protocols for handling phone calls, triaging specimens, knowing what would be sent on to the central reference lab, fielding questions. So I would want to emphasize that I think a low threshold with the protocols to deal with false positives is important. Point four is, how do you let the hospital function as near normally as possible? You should, or hopefully will, be able to continue your critical operations during a time of crisis. And this crisis can go on for some time. It can be acute, as in a man-made event, or it can be somewhat chronic, SARS, and again, pandemic flu. Now, this is easier said than done, and I think you have to have an agreement on what are the essential services for each hospital, how you have to pool and allocate those functions. And again, this is usually part of the whole disaster planning process and will have been taken care of by the disaster planners in your hospital. But what you need to know is, what would be your backup plan for an unusual disease event? Are you going to reopen hospitals? Are you going to reopen wings? Are you going to have an identified isolation hospital? And these are things that would be important, particularly from an infection control standpoint. The final point is, you know, keep it simple, stupid, to put it very rudely. When developing a plan or guide, it's so important to make it readable, to make it simple, to make it familiar. Most people really only read the first few pages of any document. And so rather than having long preambles, et cetera, get to the meat of what you want people to know in the first few pages. Who to contact, what the fallout flow sheet is, what key definitions are. Those are some of the important things to have in the first few pages. Design your protocol to look the same as other existing plans. Again, familiarity increases the success of the plan. One of the things that we found were quite important was the ability to look at task-oriented job sheets, things that inform people what they do, when they do it, how they do it, and to whom they report. And I didn't want to forget one or some of the elements that you might consider in an infection control practitioner's job action sheet. And I hope the next slide doesn't depress anyone, but these are just a few things that an infection control practitioner might want to consider on his or her agenda for unusual communicable diseases. Now, I want to stress that this doesn't mean that you're going to be doing all of these items, but you will want to have some sort of role in them, and you want to work out who is going to manage various aspects on that checklist. So, for example, I don't think you necessarily are going to be the one that's going to monitor all the engineering controls and your air handling systems and your negative pressure rooms, but you want to make sure somebody is doing it. Somebody is reporting to you or another designated authority if things go wrong or systems aren't functioning. You want to know who's in charge of inventory, who's got the authority to increase the capacity of any one or more items, and who has the authority in allocating and prioritizing where supplies will go. We learned this the hard way initially with SARS, because although we had the surge capacity with our vendor to get masks, and what we had were various areas within hospitals who had absolutely no need for these masks, pulling them from the system and creating shortages unnecessarily in other areas. So one of the take-home lessons that we took from the SARS event was to make sure that there is a system whereby how the supplies are allocated is very clear. So you've got a lot of work to do. Now, the next few slides, I want to just share with you a bit more of our experience in developing a biological response plan for our health authority. And I want to use it to highlight our successes, our failures, our controversies. And just to give you a little bit of background, after the APIC conference that was held here, we really realized that we didn't have an integrated plan at all. Instead, we had a series of individual plans that overlapped, did not coordinate, and a number of hallway conversations actually led to an ad hoc group being formed and then receiving a mandate to work from our medical health officer, who is the final authority in our municipality for management of a disaster in our region. And we formed what we called the BRAT team, the Biological Response Advisory Team. And we called it biological response because a biological event could be a bioterrorist event or it could be a natural event. And we wanted to recognize all those possibilities and not have separate plans for the two. Now, the next slide talks about the nuts and bolts of the regional plan. And it contains the indicators that signal a potential or actual biological event. And you've had that from Dr. Morse, and I'm sure you've got all those epi clues in your files tucked away somewhere. It also, though, talks about the organizational responsibilities and lines of authority, has the rapid response protocols, flowcharts, and checklists, as I've already discussed, and tells people how to access experts for opinion. The actual development of the plan went through three stages. The first one was information gathering, literature review, expert opinion, crucial liaisons within our region. And I think that now, a lot of the things that we had to do back in 1998 will be far easier for you if you haven't already done them. Back in 1998, there wasn't a lot of current information available, and now we have a plethora of information. So that is a relatively less significant event for you. Phase two, template development, is really where the time has to be spent. And as I've told you, it took us 2 years to finish our plan. Phase three is reviewing the template, and I think that should be done both internally and externally. And we sent ours out to a number of reviewers actually in the United States and in Canada. And we based our system on the incident command system, which was what was used in the region, and I've already discussed that. Next slide, please. This diagram is not for the content, but I just wanted to put it up there to show how it clearly outlines the responsibilities and it links into the existing incident command and emergency response. And it has checklists for roles and responsibilities, and I'll give you a little bit more on this later. If you go to the next slide, I've put that there as maybe a guideline to who you might want to consider to be on a response advisory team. One of the things that we considered is the team has to be 24/7. And so some of our groups were picked by those people who have call groups that are available 24/7 and or are readily accessible at all times. It does no good to have your poor person on the other end of the line trying to consult with somebody and having to go through a number of steps to find out who to talk to and how to reach them. So we kept all our contact numbers on the website as well. Now, the next slide talks about a subset of the overall municipal plan, and that's the institutional plan. And I'm just going to show you our very hospital-specific plan. The idea was that each institute has to define their own procedures while preserving the overall reporting structure and lines of communication in the region and sharing the resources wherever possible. We had to be responsible to our own institution. We had to assume initially that we may be on its own, depending upon the acuity and scope of the event. And we couldn't just focus on bioterrorism, but had to look at all potential unusual communicable diseases. Next slide, please. Now, for us specifically, our hospital regional interface is coordinated with the disaster response coordinator, and for us it's medical microbiology as we are the overseers and participants in infection control. And this, of course, you would individualize. Importantly, we recognize that there are potential multiple entry points for exposures. So while emergency is most likely, a first alert could easily come from within the hospital or a clinic. We may or may not have advance warning. We also wanted to consider that we may not always be able to tell a biochemical from a biological exposure within the first few hours. Some of the mycotoxins, for example, could mimic a biochemical event. Difficult as it is to think of, you might have a dual agent in a bioterrorist response. So we had to consider the potential for decontamination in our plan. Next slide, please. We also tried to walk through what are the different scenarios that might occur. How might an unusual communicable disease or biological exposure present? And a primary to this is that we had to keep our emergency operating free of contamination, free of exposures as much as possible, and able to function as an emergency response. Emergency was a primary goal. So we looked at three scenarios: a single patient exposure, multiple cases over time, multiple cases at once. And we were consoled somewhat by the fact that the majority of diseases are not highly communicable diseases, but we still had to consider those diseases that could be borne by the airborne route. If you look at the next slide, again, not to go through every detail, but just to give you a feeling for what we considered when we looked at a single case scenario, we thought that this was probably the most containable in a timely fashion, that we may know about it or not, and that the assessment or management is always predicated on protecting our staff, our other patients, and our visitors. We also tried to prepare for a scenario where the patient has been retrospectively identified on the ward, and you'll see more of this on the next slide. And as I said before, we linked both sub-scenarios to our pre-existing unusual communicable disease plan. And, of course, the full details for all of this is on the website that's referenced at the back. When we looked at multiple cases over time, which is your slide 30, I believe, this was really the most likely and the most sobering scenario, because it's likely that there are many other infectious patients out there, and what you see may just be the tip of the iceberg. You may already have cases on your ward. Staff may already be affected as well. And important to this is a triage system to prevent cases slipping through undetected, and as well a method whereby the wards are systematically reviewed for cases. The other thing that you have to consider is how would you restrict or at the very least control entry into your site? And I think many of us have had experience with that with SARS, so we've learned some of our lessons there. Again, the other element is preparing for further cases. The last scenario, multiple cases arriving at once, is the most dramatic and really, hopefully, the least likely. It's also, quite frankly, our most controversial protocol and one everyone struggled with. There are multiple things to consider, and today the purpose is not to go into every one of those details, but to encourage you to consider all possible scenarios. Again, the need to leave the emergency room functioning, the recognition that you may not be able to identify what the exact type of event is initially, the fact that you may need decontamination. Hazmat teams are often available in large municipalities, but not in small. Hazmat could be overwhelmed, or it's estimated in some of the exercises that have been done that around 20% or higher of patients will voluntarily walk into your site. So you have to consider this. And I think the other thing that you have to consider is what you're going to use for a decontam area and a triage area. And I've listed these things here. I'll go over them at the end. But they're really the engineering controls that you need to manage large groups of people for triage or decontamination. The next two slides just give you some examples of checklists, and I've had to actually cut them down and paste them so they don't look as they would in the document and they don't have all the reporting, etc. But it was just to give you a feel of how you might do a checklist. It should be a sheet that stands alone, that identifies who's going to be responsible for it, what they're going to do, and a way to monitor that they have done what they're supposed to do by simply checking off what they need to do. The next slide, which is one looking at the actual setup of the decontam site, would be the responsibility in our situation for security systems and a core emerge group. And again, just gives you a feel for the things, all the things and details that you might have to consider. I've shown you two pictures of my hospital to remind myself to talk to you about the importance of engineering controls when planning. Controlling access to the site is key, and I think many of the guidelines, particularly the JCAHO recommendations on decontamination and triaging, emphasize the importance of having those triage or decontamination sites away from your core emergency area. And so in your plan, you should consider where you would set up these sites and what you need for them. So, for example, at our hospital, actually one of our old little tuck shops or gift shops is going to be made into an enclosed assessment area for small groups of people, but our roofed-in emergency area is going to have water plumbed to the outside. That's warm water, and Velcro hooks and tabs for tarps to be put up for assessment and, if possible and needed, decontamination. Controversial to us, in the next slide I've shown you the entrance to our morgue area, which is close by emergency, and actually in a larger situation, the emergency parking lot will be the staging area, and some of the decontamination could actually take place in our morgue. I know it sounds horrendous, but it's an area that can be shut down for some time without significantly impacting on patient care. It has drains in the floors, sprinkler systems, and a totally controlled air handling system, as well as lecture theater to hold people. So, you know, you may have to think outside the box where you might set up a decontam area. Think of all possibilities. Finally, the last phase in disaster planning, recovery. And as I said, that should hopefully be going on at the same time as a response. What I wanted to emphasize here was the absolute importance of including a review of the plan, what went wrong and what went well. And I think one of the things I'd like to say is that the intention in a review is not to assign blame or point fingers. It's to make the system better so that you don't repeat mistakes and irregularities or lapses or things you hadn't thought of before are addressed at that time. You're going to, of course, after review, make revisions. And this is where document control is extremely important. You don't want 5 different versions of your unusual communicable disease plan floating around your institution. And so you have to think of a system whereby you would control the documents, clearly date them, assign who's responsible for pulling the old documents if necessary or having a system for that, labeling what versions are current, posting them on any internal or external website, and make sure that the documents can't be altered by unauthorized persons. And that's quite important. After you've done all your revisions, retesting is really important. And that can be something as simple as a paper exercise to a drill to getting external reviewers to take a look at what you do. But retesting is part of the whole recovery and review process. Now, I want to end with, again, some personal observations that people may or may not agree with. Pandemic influenza planning is, and planning for SARS has a lot of synergy with planning for other unusual communicable diseases and disaster events. And if you think about it and look at your or our national pandemic flu plan, for example, the pre-pandemic and post-pandemic phases really fit the 4 elements of mitigation and preparedness, response and recovery. So pre-pandemic is identifying your hazards, your vulnerable areas, and preparing for what you need to do. Pandemic, if you look at the plan, you'll see that response and recovery actions are taking place at the same time. And post-pandemic is the recovery phase with the review and the revisions and the scaling back up that is needed. One of the things that we had as a recent experience, just to totally switch tracks here for a minute, is that, of course, one of the elements to an unusual communicable disease response is the need for a vaccination, antibiotic, or antiviral distribution clinics. And I think it's going to be a lot harder than we imagined. We had a recent rabies exposure here that had been in the hospital for, or in another hospital for approximately a month with a very large number of people exposed. And we completely underestimated the time that it would take to counsel individuals when they're dealing with an unusual event. It's different from lining people up to give them a flu shot. There's a lot of counseling, a lot of fear. And one of the very practical things I hope I can share with you is really consider that and don't underestimate your resource need for a vaccination or antibiotic distribution clinic. Your infrastructure is going to be lost or at the very least compromised, and so mitigation is so important, particularly because we're already working at our maximum capacity. Oftentimes the best we can do is to identify the lack of resources and lobby with our key administrators and executives. The other thing is to not underestimate your resource need. We tend to do this, And there's no harm if you're looking at upscaling your inventory and having prearranged agreements with vendors to make sure that that's quite generous. And finally, for this slide, is fear and anxiety. They are major factors. It's not just the patients and the families, but the staff. They're worried about their safety. They're worried about the safety of their families. We have to make provisions so that the staff feel secure. And we have to make provisions so that there are people who are trained to counsel the staff. And key to all of this is communication, making sure that staff are kept abreast of what's going on. And that minimizes the confusion and the anxiety factor. But I think people often underestimate what your counseling resources are going to be needed for all the stresses that take place when you're dealing with a disaster. So I wanted to make sure that I did emphasize that point. The next slide, which I think is slide 38, just emphasizes the need to recognize unusual communicable events early. And I personally think that you should incorporate surveillance for unusual communicable diseases or even clusters of usual infections such as a bunch of chickenpox all of a sudden or influenza or pneumonias into the daily routine of your schedule as an infection control practitioner, but also for staff. And the next slide just gives you, again, our highly egocentric look here at Vancouver General Hospital. And again, content is not important here. The illustration is that, again, I personally think that algorithms and protocols should be built into your system. And I've just shown you our respiratory and or febrile illness not yet diagnosed algorithm, which staff use to guide them from the beginning of the process of the patient being recognized in eMERGE or on the ward to what they need to do. The next slide might hopefully give those of you who have automated systems some hints on how you can make your life a heck of a lot easier by including it into your automatic flagging system. Many of us flag for MRSA, VRE, tuberculosis. We have an identified screen on our information systems, and ours is there in that lower box, as you can see. And we incorporated it just the same way that we do MRSA and VRE so that people at the ward or emergency level can actually initiate an alert electronically, again, according to the algorithm. To make our life even easier, as you can see by the next slide, our information systems people were actually fairly easily, I was quite surprised, to build us a census report. So every day an automatic report is printed out that lists all the people that are flagged A for airborne in our case. And then we can quickly go around and access those people. You'll see here that one of our infection control practitioners has looked at a patient with Crohn's disease who had chickenpox, for example. That was the previous slide. And how we can keep an idea as to what's going on in our hospital as for airborne diseases and more readily identify clusters. And we at first thought that we were going to have a lot of false positives, and actually in the first couple of months we did until everybody became a little clearer and we refined our protocols. We thought it would be a lot of work, but actually as part of our daily ward service, it really wasn't any more onerous. So I firmly believe that it can be done. Finally, the last set of personal observations, and that's to do with your ties with other people. What happens between public health and hospitals is extremely important. Public health and hospitals are inextricably tied, and what one does has an impact on the other. And I would encourage everyone to foster your ties with public health and reach an understanding of what each other's role is and an appreciation of how changing policies on either side affects the individual, and work together on this. I think, again, it's important to know your key personnel in advance so that in a disaster, you're not meeting for the first time and not dealing with all of the stresses that go through with meeting new individuals and understanding their roles and where they're coming from. And finally, you have to have buy-in from administration. If you don't have it from the start, at the very minimum, you're doomed to limited success. At the worst, you are doomed to failure. If I had to give you 4 take-home points, I think they would be the importance of a surveillance system and the need to identify anybody who's potentially exposed or infectious, and to have that system inbuilt and as ingrained as possible in your institution. I think I've been rather monotonous on going on about how it's important to have a coordinated response, but here it is for you again. And I think that the templates have to be flexible. They have to allow for multiple entry points for potential exposures. They have to permit anyone to start the alert and not be intimidated or scared because, you know, they're the nurse and someone else is a doctor, for example. I think you really have to be quite generous with your templates but understand how you can refine it to minimize your false positives. And in the end, there are lots of templates out that I would encourage people to use, but the bottom line is you still have to individualize your plan and involve your key players right from the beginning. I'll leave you with a quote or two that talks about emergencies and a list of references. And California, you'll see that you're in there for your excellent guide. I do want to make one correction, and that is the third bullet from the bottom. Horror of horrors, I have spelt our web address wrong. It should be www.vcn, not VCH. So I apologize for that typo and hope you will correct it. And I'll just repeat it again. It's the City of Vancouver Exposure to Biological Agents Response Plan, and the first part of the address should be www.vcn. And with that, I thank you for your time and would be happy to entertain any questions.
Well, thank you very much for that, Dr. Bryce. As always, you have been characteristically thorough in your preparation and presentation. I have a question for you. A little bit more than a year ago, somebody walked into one of your hospitals with an active case of SARS. How did you handle that? Obviously, it didn't spread very far. What mechanisms made that work for you?
Right. Just to set the scenario for people, particularly in the United States who might be on the line, we had 3 of the 5 imported cases in Canada, and we had one healthcare worker at the end of the event who had been affected, who was outside our region. I think that was really important for us is that our emergency staff knew from the onset what to do with a person who has a respiratory disease of unknown significance. And they just used the protocol as they always used it. And in fact, the patient went all the way through right up to our ICU with the procedures in place. And our intensive care staff actually were rather surprised that, we would be upset because they didn't notify us right away because, of course, they know how to handle respiratory illnesses. I should be clear that our first patient came in March the 8th, and the first SARS bulletins didn't come through until March the 12th. In that crucial interval, the patient was managed appropriately. We did admittedly have some luck on our side. The patient's wife had been ill but had recovered, and we didn't have a large number of family members coming into our site. We also had extremely with it emergency staff and intensive care unit staff, and really the credit goes to them for managing things so well. When we had our other cases in, we had identified our potential SARS hospital. So unless they needed critical life support, they went to the SARS isolation hospital to be managed. And that kept, as much as possible during this event, our emergencies as free as possible. And, of course, nothing's ever perfect. And we had our BRAT plan, and we knew each other. So when we developed our SARS guidelines, it was facilitated by having people aware of what the original template was.
Very good. Thank you. I want to say thank you again to our faculty today, Dr. Bryce, and thank you all for joining us. We'll talk again soon. Goodbye.